A warning for listeners. This episode contains brief mentions of violence and sexual assault.
The weather has been unseasonably warm this summer in northern Wisconsin, warm enough to simmer off several inches of marsh in the swampland surrounding Fort McCoy, the tall, bottle-green grasses where summer-month soldiers of the National Guard ordinarily simulate field maneuvers. Since the late spring, though, Fort McCoy has been home, church, and processing point to upwards of 20,000 Cuban refugees who escaped or were released
into the United States. It's June 1980. And Osvaldo Durruti has just stepped foot in the United States for the first time as part of the Mariel boat lift. After arriving in Key West, Florida, he's tried his first apple and had his first proper mess hall experience with an all-you-can-eat buffet. Soon after, he's whisked away to Wisconsin. And once he arrives at Fort McCoy, he quickly realizes he's about to live in soldiers' barracks.
We're getting out of the buses, and everybody trying to run to get a room, because, you know, it's barrack. You got, you know, four rooms, and the rest is open, you know. So
Osvaldo says he and others were running to get private rooms. They don't want to stay in these big open rooms in the barracks, crammed in with dozens of other people.
Once Osvaldo takes out his bed, the scramble doesn't end. He spots something outside.
I see in the street something that looks like a refrigerator. And I say to my guy, let's grab a refrigerator and put it in the bread rack so we can have, you know, cold beer and everything. And when we ran from here to like, you know, by the tree. And I realized, man, it looked too big for a refrigerator. And when we enter the open, we get surprised, the surprise of the lifetime. Guess what? Guess what it was? It was a restroom.
Yup, that wasn't a refrigerator for cold beer. It was a porta potty.
And for Cuban refugees like Osvaldo, this is just the beginning of the new and eye-opening experiences in Wisconsin. Soy Omar Granados.
And I'm Maureen McCollum. This is Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio.
So here we go. We're checking into Fort McCoy.
Can imagine what they look like from
I know.
A bus the first time.
We're with the public affairs. Thank you. You too.
Back in the spring of 2021, Omar and I were able to visit Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin. It was one of four U.S. military installations that housed Cuban refugees after the Mariel boat lift. Almost 15,000 Cubans lived here in the summer of 1980.
Recording. How do you feel that we're driving in here, Omar?
It's pretty scary, actually, since I've never been here. And driving in, I was able to see some of the barracks and some of the, barbed fence wire that I've been reading about for so long. There's a lot of land.
It's a lot of land.
It's very isolated from everything. I mean, it took kind of long and lonely roads to get here, and obviously there's military vehicles everywhere. And
I know, I just keep thinking about what they were thinking as they got here.
I was thinking about that, too, as we were driving in. I mean, Cubans are island people. We grow up surrounded by the sea. At Fort McCoy, you're essentially landlocked.
On May 9th, 1980, just 18 days after the first boats arrived in Key West from the port of Mariel, Fort McCoy's staff received orders from Washington to start preparing for the arrival of Cuban refugees. And this story may sound familiar. About halfway through our reporting for this podcast, thousands of Afghan refugees were also sent to Fort McCoy in 2021. It was the first resettlement effort there since the Cubans arrived in 1980.
They say Fort McCoy has been working to expand its capacity and will be able to host 13,000 Afghan refugees by Sunday. Officials say the majority of people are arriving as families, and a large number are children, including infants. Many people are arriving with men.
Yes, I was receiving a lot of phone calls at this time.
mostly folks from the press trying to compare the situation of the Afghan refugees with the history of the Cuban refugees at Fort McCoy. But it was evident right away that the Afghan refugees were being welcomed differently than the Cubans when this happened more than 40 years ago.
Back then, in 1980, staff had to act fast to make Fort McCoy a resettlement center. It needed to house a lot of people very quickly.
Well, that may have been one of the reasons Fort McCoy was chosen, because that was kind of our role, and still is, to ramp up real suddenly.
That's Ryan Howell, the garrison archaeologist at Fort McCoy.
I mean, that goes back to World War II here.
Okay.
And so a lot of these facilities were basically being held vacant in case there was a war incident or something like that where you needed to ramp up the facilities here.
And that's so there, super interesting.
This would have been one of the few bases that had the ability to bring that many people in.
Every summer we train thousands of soldiers. I think we had about more than 150,000 soldiers trained in a year is not unusual. So we have housing for them.
And that's Tanya Townsell, the public affairs coordinator at Fort McCoy.
And Fort McCoy was able to handle that load.
Fort McCoy was built in 1909 in southwest Wisconsin's Driftless region. In addition to offering training, some units have mobilized at Fort McCoy before deployment. During World War II, what was then known as Camp McCoy became a Japanese, German, and Italian internment camp. These were American civilians who were arrested and considered, quote, potentially dangerous enemy aliens, end quote. The following year, it transitioned to a prisoner of war camp, holding more than 10,000 German, Japanese, and Korean POWs. Almost 35 years later, in 1980, Fort McCoy was selected to ramp up again to house the Cuban refugees following the Mariel boatlift.
And one of the reasons the government selected Fort McCoy was because it's so isolated.
And in a way, Ernesto Rodriguez, who now lives in La Crosse, is living proof of what you're talking about, Omar. After he arrived in Key West and chugged a few Cokes, he had to board a plane that same day. He was sent to Miami, where he spent the night.
And then in the morning, there was a big plane. He said, you see the plane over there? Get in there. Will you get in the plane? And I don't know where we was.
They didn't tell you.
They not tell me where they're going to take me.
Ernie had no clue he was on his way to Wisconsin, or that Wisconsin was even a place.
I know New York, Los Angeles, California, Miami, Florida.
Chicago.
Chicago, but I never hear Illinois.
Right. No. That makes sense.
Yeah. Only the big city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when I look in the window, you know, I see the Mississippi. You know, I think it looked like an ocean. Like a big river. We land there, get out of the plane, taking a school bus for McCoy.
At this point, Erne is just being processed, right, Omar?
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, the refugees are starting their lives in the United States as detainees. They're spending time with federal officials who are interviewing and interrogating them. They can't get out of Fort McCoy without a family member or sponsor vouching for them. And this makes a more difficult transition from detainee to community member.
And while they wait for sponsors or family, they need food, healthcare, and of course, places to sleep.
So this is a building that would have been a lot like where the refugees would have
very much
slept. Okay.
The barracks at Fort McCoy looked pretty bare bones. They're two stories with long, narrow rooms and a decent amount of sunlight entering through the windows. Tanya Townsell leads us up the stairs. This is where the refugees would have slept. The walls in this room are lined with twin-sized metal-framed beds. It was interesting to imagine that 50 people would have lived in one of these rooms at the same time.
You know what? No air conditioning, no window screens for mosquitoes, no real insulation. These things would have been interesting to live in the middle of Wisconsin summer and then in the middle of Wisconsin fall.
An American sponsor overseen by a group of mostly young Americans privates of the National Guard, policemen from the regular army, teachers, social workers, and official interpreters such as Rebecca Wenzel.
To meet the other basic needs of the Cuban refugees, the federal government hired more than 1,000 people to work and volunteer as kitchen staff, teachers, and medical personnel. One of them was Rich Rice of La Crosse.
So we simply rolled out to the La Crosse airport with a single ambulance and two EMTs on board. And all of a sudden, you know, we're presented with a plane load of refugees.
In the summer of 1980, Rich was 25 years old and working as a basic EMT for Tri-State Ambulance in La Crosse. The company had received a federal contract to be emergency responders focused on the refugees. The job started right on the tarmac.
And then we were doing medical triage as these folks came off the airplane, and they were in all kinds of medical conditions. Some were healthy and happy and walked to a bus, and others needed to literally be carried from the airplane.
And remember, there's a language barrier. Rich had to learn new phrases really fast, like, ¿dónde le duele? Or, ¿where does it hurt?
There was rumors of some of these guys being, you know, beat up a bit before they left the country, or being kind of manhandled a bit in whatever way. So some injuries there. I remember seeing a fractured leg and kind of a lumbar splint. You know, they had a piece of wood and some t-shirts tied around it or whatever to kind of hold his leg in place. And so there were some.
Rich says each day became more organized than the last as he and his colleagues treated people at the airport and at Fort McCoy.
And then their infrastructure began to develop. You know, they developed clinics, and certain buildings would be like maybe an all-male clinic, and an all-female clinic, and a family clinic. And there was, you know, physicians rotating in, both military and private sector physicians rolling in. And so it really became a pretty full-blown medical operation. You know, that was all it ultimately kind of happened, but we had to watch that, just kind of like building a little village, basically, you know, from scratch.
This little village that Rich is talking about now has housing, a healthcare system, and dining halls. And as all of that comes together, the Cubans are finding ways to pass the time.
I used to like walking and running around, you know, play card, Cuban card. Mm-hmm.
That's Ernesto Rodriguez, who now lives in La Crosse.
Play baseball, talk with the people in the park and there. Mm-hmm.
Erne's roommate in La Crosse, Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Nino, was basically doing the same things every day at Fort McCoy.
Well, I used to run a lot, you know. I used to run before for hours and walk and stand, play card, play baseball sometimes.
Here's some reporting from NPR in 1980.
Dominoes, soccer, and baseball are played. Baseball leagues are being organized. But you can only play so many games of baseball before it gets boring.
And we are developing a lot of sport programs, a lot of recreation, educational programs.
Their aim here is to keep the refugees busy while relocation officials keep busy trying to resettle them. A Spanish language newspaper from Chicago is mailed up here. They are taught English.
But people are not here to play baseball or cards. They want to get out of Fort McCoy and start their lives in the United States. And in order to get out, they have to fill out a lot of paperwork with translators, people like Rosa Hamilton. When I talked to her at her home a few years back, she told me she was working as a high school teacher in Sparta, Wisconsin.
They just hire whoever could speak Spanish, yeah. Whoever yeah. They told them that knew some Spanish. We had people from all over coming in to Fort McCoy and wanting the interpreting.
The federal government needed people to help the new arrivals fill out paperwork, deal with medical questions, and find family members across the United States. So Rosa ended up bringing her Sparta High School students to work as translators. Some students were advanced, while others still had a lot to learn.
Some of them were not really into the, you know, Spanish too. They were not going to understand so much. To hire them to do the interview for immigration.
So a lot of room for error there.
Oh, yeah. Lots of errors.
Sometimes important errors, The translators are handling things like name changes, criminal records, and medical records. This is important information, but the government was so desperate for translators that officials had to settle for high school and college students, who were still learning the language themselves.
Rosa not only had her high school students from Sparta, she started a classroom for Cuban children and teenagers at Fort McCoy.
It was a little school. I had my little bell early in the morning with a lot of candy, and the kids followed me. So we started in one of the barracks. They gave me a classroom.
Soon, Rosa's classroom started to fill up.
I started teaching English to the children, and they were learning fast. So the parents saw that, and they started coming too with the kids. And we would do all kinds of activities to make them go very fun, to have fun time while waiting, you know. And those teenagers also wanted to come for some classes.
Rosa was even able to take some of the teens on field trips off the base. Here's an article from the La Crosse Tribune in 1980.
After school, they boarded a school bus and rode to Cataract, 12 miles north of Sparta, for a picnic party at the Cataract Mill campground. While at the campground, the refugees cooked hamburgers over charcoal, ate potato chips and pickles, drank canned pop, played volleyball, croquet and pool, and listened and danced to records. "For the first time, I feel free," said one of the boys as he boarded the bus for the return ride to Fort McCoy.
Rosa ended up forming a bond with a number of Mariel refugees, and these relationships between Cuban exiles and local staff at Fort McCoy were pretty common.
One of the ways Cuban exiles and Fort McCoy staff bonded was through food. When Ernesto Rodriguez wasn't playing cards or walking around, he spent a lot of time hanging out in a kitchen, showing the American staff how to make Cuban food.
Black bean, rice, a lot of rice, a lot of black bean, meat, chicken.
This was a big deal since the Cubans hadn't developed a taste for American food yet.
One day he said, "Are you guys like macaroni and cheese? What the hell is macaroni and cheese? I know macaroni, but you put the cheese in the macaroni?" Yeah.
So some Cubans passed the time essentially teaching cooking classes. Others were going to Catholic Mass, something they couldn't do back in Cuba. And others listened to music. Cuban music was broadcast throughout Fort McCoy on a camp-run radio station, WRPC. It was even profiled on NPR's All Things Considered in September 1980.
WRPC is the only real link most of the refugees have with the outside world. They depend on radio for national and international news, for the weather, for information about camp activities, for music of their own culture.
Muy buenas tardes, hermanos y hermanas cubanas. WRPC, Fuerte McCoy, Wisconsin, La Voz de la Libertad, presenta las noticias de hoy, del 4 de septiembre.
It is mostly salsa music, but there are occasional songs from the Rolling Stones, the Bee Gees, John Coltrane, Louis Armstrong, or from the refugees' own musical group, formed at Fort McCoy and recorded in the studios of WRPC.
And one of the Fort McCoy musicians was Osvaldo Durruti, who now lives in Madison.
I never was a musician. I just copied people dancing. You know, I was a good dancer. But, you know, I never play any instrument whatsoever. So after that moment, I started playing, you know, the instrument, the bongo, you know, and I qualified.
That's right, he qualified. He became a member of one of the Fort McCoy bands as a bongo player and dancer.
There was a group, musician. We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places, and that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy, you know. I just want to get away, you know. You're gonna meet people, new faces, Americans, and you know.
This band played for people at Fort McCoy and ended up touring around the Midwest while they were still living in the barracks.
Yeah, there was hope that efforts like this could help the Cubans find sponsors. These folks were basically ambassadors of Cuban culture in Wisconsin touring around the Midwest. They're trying to improve the image of Cuban people and the stereotype that the criminals at Fort McCoy, you know. It was not only music, but they would also go to high schools to play baseball with high school students. And, you know, it was good press for the refugees.
Another way to get good press for the refugees was through their own newspaper.
It was called El Mercurio de McCoy. Government officials hired local staff to write articles in English and Spanish. People like Will Ferguson and Adolf Gunderson.
My name is Adolf Gunderson. Like Will, I'm a La Crosse native, and we met early in our lives, second grade to be precise, and then overlapped at several instances during our lives. One, a big one was Fort McCoy.
In the summer of 1980, the two lifelong friends and UW-Madison Spanish majors had just wrapped up a semester abroad in Spain, and they needed jobs. It was either babysit or take on this new exciting opportunity working with Cuban refugees at Fort McCoy.
We were sort of herded into a big room. I remember us sitting on a wood floor, and then a military individual came in with a clipboard and asked who wanted to fill certain positions. And the first one on his list was media or press interpreters. And I nudged Will, who was sitting next to me, because we knew each other. And I said, boy, that sounds like a really interesting job. So let's do that. So we put our hands up, and it was just, you know, first one past the post. And so that's how we ended up being press interpreters.
So in addition to working as interpreters and media liaisons, they worked on El Mercurio. Well, Ferguson explains what they were trying to do with the paper.
We were trying to answer some of the questions that the Cubans had. Simply, what's going on here? What's happening in the world? As well as what's happening in the camp? And it seemed really important to try to get that right. You know, telling them what are the most important stories nationwide, worldwide, and then what's happening here.
And I do remember cutting up articles and that sort of thing. But there was also the non-press-related content of El Mercurio, which I would say was sort of like civics education and other kinds of things about this is what life in America is going to be like. So there was day-to-day news, and then there was also, like, I would call it like cultural education.
There were also sports scores, resettlement updates, and English lessons.
Yes, one interesting aspect to me as I go through El Mercurio is the amount of profiles that we find on the Cuban refugees themselves. In my opinion, these are profiles that seem like a way to get people sponsored. You see stories about the refugees' talents, you see stories about their past in Cuba, and always trying to explain any kind of criminal history as a way of describing the injustice of living under Fidel Castro's government at the time.
Also, El Mercurio serves as a really invaluable piece of history, right, Omar? So, like, when you read it, what do you take away from this newspaper?
One aspect that really stands out to me as I read the stories is the relationships that developed between volunteers and camp personnel and even military folks and the refugees. We're talking about interracial networks of solidarity that did not exist later after the refugees left the camp. Relationships between Black people from Cuba and white people from Wisconsin that were very, very close within the camp.
And El Mercurio had every article written in English and Spanish.
Yes, and the Spanish and the English versions sometimes had very different tones. English was at times harsh and condescending, while Spanish was perhaps more conversational and had a more familiar or practical tone. An example that I always use to illustrate this, for example, is the English language homework that was published daily by El Mercurio. We see a lot of activities where refugees are supposed to practice the names of tools or, you know, how to say hammer, how to say drill, but we don't see anything about how to say university or book or pencil or desk. So in a way, that is an assumption, a condescending assumption from that, you know, part of the publication. Then we see another space that actually counteracts that narrative, and it's the Spanish cartoons and comics that were made by refugees, you know, where you see messages of don't throw trash away where we are living every day, or don't be stupid, be grateful, and don't jump the fence because that will get everybody in trouble and slow down the process. So a more practical message there.
All right, so El Mercurio covered a lot. There were these reminders for people to stay out of trouble, and there were those cartoons that Omar just talked about discouraging people from jumping the fence. And that's because some people desperately wanted to get out of Fort McCoy.
And many of the reasons why they wanted out were not covered by El Mercurio. That side of the camp, coming up after the break.
You're listening to Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Bridget Bowden, podcast host for WPR Reports. If you're enjoying Uprooted, then join me and Sean Johnson for Derailed. It's an investigative podcast about all the twists and turns in Wisconsin's saga for passenger rail. We tell the story of how the project came together, how it fell apart, and how it changed the state. To subscribe and find more, visit WPR.org/derailed or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum, host of WPR Reports, Uprooted. I'm passionate about storytelling. Stories give us an opportunity to understand another person's experience. They help shape, reinforce, or challenge our views and values. Member support made today's powerful narrative possible. Bring tomorrow's stories to life with your gift now at WPR.org/donate. There's a studio gallery in downtown La Crosse that is stocked with treasures. At Satori Arts, you can find a John Lennon print and antique Chinese furniture. Earrings and necklaces fill the display cases. And tucked in the back are some priceless hidden gems packed neatly into boxes.
Can you, for the radio audience who can't see this right now, can you describe what we're looking at?
This is an army blanket that was turned into a jacket.
Wow.
John Satori owns this art gallery and also worked at Fort McCoy in 1980.
So, because it was cold when they were there, you know, so they were wearing something to keep warm because actually they weren't, a lot of times weren't given proper, you know, clothing. So this was made, this is one of them.
There's a name on the inside. Can you read that?
Well, this is the name of the person who made it. I have a picture of him wearing it.
Oh, cool. Carlos Torres.
John has art created by the Mariel refugees. Purses made from box straps and a hat made from cardboard. Remember in the first episode when Armando Rodriguez found his father on a list of all the Cuban refugees at Fort McCoy? He dug through that stack of papers here at John's gallery. John was serving in the Army Medical Corps' dental clinic when he acquired a lot of these pieces.
Well, I was working in a hospital area, and after everyone was, like, leaving, stuff was just being dumped.
Mm-hmm.
So being a picker as I am, I picked up some things because I knew that this was history.
Yeah.
You know, and it's got to be remembered.
John Satori was treating the Cuban refugees, and he developed a good relationship with some of the people. He would bring them art supplies and commission them to do artwork.
I'll say, you know, could you draw me a picture? Or they might even have some pictures where they'll take with them and they'll try to sell to us.
Mm.
So we would either trade or buy or commission. So I do have pictures on board where they would actually take like a glue and make it more three-dimensional by raising the colors and then painting onto that. So so I have some of that, but it was always bright colors. A lot of bright colors, you know, it wasn't.
Some of the most impressive pieces are the paintings that Cuban artists did on bedsheets.
Bright and colorful paintings of La Virgen de la Caridad del Cobre, the patron saint of Cuba, plus another of Jesus.
John pulls out a pair of brightly colored drawings. One depicts what the artist hoped life would be like in the United States. Omar, Armando Rodriguez, and I gather around the drawing of life in Cuba.
Living in Cuba. So he did this picture. This is the picture he said was kind of like where he was living.
Does this look familiar to either of you two?
Absolutely. Well, that's, you know, we see royal palm trees. We see bohío, which is a very traditional type of home built in the countryside of Cuba. And, you know, the river and the sun shining brings you back home.
Yeah.
The next picture is, this is what he expected when he came to America. Car, swimming pool, nice big house, you know.
Then, John pulled out a third piece of art. This drawing is not an American dream.
Do one of you want to describe what's going on in this painting of Castro here?
One of you guys?
Yeah. Armando, why don't you talk about this? This is...
yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's intense.
You don't have to talk about it or explain it if you don't want.
So what we're seeing, it's a picture of a giant young Fidel Castro, very heavily armed and basically ripping people's bodies with his own hands. He's standing on what seems to be the island of Cuba, and in the back we can see what looks like mareel boats full of people trying to leave the island, and, you know, it's a very violent and powerful image of what I think represents the trauma that these migrants endured during the exodus.
Political and religious works of art, like these, were a way of expressing what they wouldn't or couldn't say to the Cuban government back on the island.
It was also a vehicle for processing their trauma of cultural displacement. Sadly, many of the Cubans faced more trauma at Fort McCoy.
The recommendation of the State Commission, which called the camp a dangerous place, the strong and brutal prey on the weak, the small, and the sick.
We've shared stories about how sometimes it was dangerous inside Fort McCoy. In the first episode of this podcast, Enrique Morey says he doesn't like talking about his time there.
I know one I even remember.
Yeah.
This was a Wild West. A Wild West.
Other people felt the same.
I don't like Fort McCoy. I want to get out of here.
No,
right
there.
What was like the, I mean, besides
many,
obvious
too
reasons?
Fight, too many fight for people used to, you know, fight before in prison, then when he come dead.
Yeah. There used to be an enemy. Yeah.
That's Ernesto Rodriguez and Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Nino, recalling the fights they had regularly witnessed and avoided between people who had been enemies in Cuban prison.
Because the government here in the United States, they didn't know anything about, you know.
Right, they didn't know, yeah.
Exactly.
Like who to separate.
Yeah,
and...
a few enemies.
Cubans who had already faced danger getting to the United States were now facing danger in the United States. There was racism, homophobia, and sexism. Pile on an uncertainty about your own future, and it's safe to say people were on edge. Omar, we hear a lot about violence at Fort McCoy. It wasn't everywhere, but it was happening a lot.
Yes, mostly theft, assaults, fights, you know, all rivalries from Cuba. And sexual assault, mostly on minors.
And it wasn't just the Cuban refugees. In a La Crosse Tribune article, Fort McCoy commander Colonel William Moran says, quote, "I was convinced and still am that an awful lot of things the Cubans got blamed for were not the Cubans," end quote. He goes on to say, sure, some of the exiles were involved in things like larceny and break-ins and assaults, but so were some of the 1,000 people he hired to work there.
two knifings, two uprisings in certain barracks with guard fences being torn down, and almost innumerable reports of child molestation, robbery, assault, sexual abuse.
We read letters from teenagers in the first episode, kids who feared for their safety because of the thefts, stabbings, and sexual assaults taking place. Although only a small percentage of the people at Fort McCoy were dangerous, they were wreaking havoc on camp life. Here's John Satori again.
But then later on, we had a problem because there were fractions almost like gangs or like almost like a mafia type thing. And they were like forcing women into prostitution and things like that because they were in a compound that they weren't with their families or anything else. It was really a problem. And keep you up at night sometimes because there was a lot of some problems there that was happening that you didn't really want to see happen. And the government was also keeping some of those stories quiet. You know, there would be a stabbing or something like that. You knew it happened, but it never got out, you know. And I would be at the hospital and ambulances are coming in and they're unloading people. And it's like, nothing happened here, you know, type of thing. So it was a lot of it was kept quiet. And then they did have problems with the military police.
The military police, or MPs, they had jurisdiction inside Fort McCoy. These were also the people in charge of the perimeter. So as refugees jumped the fence to escape, the MPs, along with the U.S. Marshals, would bring him back.
I tried to take off one time.
That's Armando Rodriguez, the miner who used to meet his dad at the fence inside Fort McCoy.
Why did you try to take off?
Because people we start getting, being there so long. So I just crossed the fence, tried to leave, but they catch me. So I went back and never tried no more.
Yeah.
People who tried to escape sometimes faced harsh discipline once they were caught. Here's an editorial from the La Crosse Tribune in 1980 that talks about what happened to some teenagers who tried to escape, reported by Detroit Free Press staff.
It is a footnote to the story of the government's Cuban refugee resettlement program at Fort McCoy this summer. But Wisconsin public defenders recently found two more teenage refugees after weeks of searching. One had been held in virtual isolation for 2 months and 13 days. He was about to go under mentally, attorney A. Gridley Hall said. His crime? He tried to escape from Fort McCoy. The other was found in the same detention center in the same type of 12-by-12 isolation cell. The kid was so doped up he could hardly talk, Hall said. His crime? He tried to escape from Fort McCoy. Escape attempts seem logical, even to the state attorneys who say the way the government has run the camp would be laughable if the results weren't so much human suffering.
Here's John Satori again, the art gallery owner who worked in the Fort McCoy Dental Clinic. As a heads up, he tells a pretty disturbing story.
Well, we did have a problem with people taking like pencils and pushing up into their, you know, teeth and all that stuff, so it'd be bleeding gums and all that. Mm-hmm. And then it would show, look at them, you know. And so they would get to go into the bus, go to the clinic. They really didn't have any problems, but that was their chance to get out and maybe sell things or have soda pop or whatever.
There's a number of motivations that people could have had to do something like this, particularly the minors. Escaping from threats from internal gangs. They could have been involved in trading in the black market. So yes, getting products that they couldn't access. And a lot of people just wanted to get out of the base and maybe they thought they would be sent to a hospital in town.
Remember, everything at Fort McCoy came together really quickly. And that includes the security plan. A number of federal agencies were running things at Fort McCoy, but it was the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, that was overseeing the entire resettlement operation. We did reach out to FEMA with a number of questions, but the agency did not have anyone available for comment.
Yes, and it's important to remember that FEMA is only about 1 year old at this time, and this was their first big mission, So there is policing taking place in Fort McCoy, and FEMA is relying on Cubans to police one another. FEMA and MPs don't understand the cultural codes taking place or the dynamics that have been brought from Cuba into Fort McCoy. Plus, there's a language barrier. So they start relying on the jefes, the members of the Cuban self-governing executive committee, to police the barracks.
During the middle of the summer, Fort McCoy was showcased among the nation's refugee camps. The army officers here instituted a form of self-administration, the jefes, or individual leaders elected from the barracks who wear red acrylic caps.
These jefes, they were also referred to as war hawks. That's because they wore donated purple jackets with the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater's war hawk mascot on the back.
The jefes enjoyed certain flexibility moving through the camp areas and received extra supplies. They also worked supporting orderly distribution of food and monitored cultural events and sport competitions. More importantly, jefes would keep FEMA and camp officials informed about any escape or rioting attempts. And they also worked closely with unaccompanied minors. They were allowed to carry weapons, like knives or sticks, and this contributed to things sometimes getting out of hand.
While some were good people, there was corruption among the jefes. Some were accused of abusing minors.
The jefes remain in place, but regular American Army units have been brought in on patrol. The recommendation of a state commission which called the camp a dangerous place, with the strong and brutal prey on the weak, the small, and the sick.
Some people felt preyed upon by the jefes and one another. Some didn't feel safe or protected by FEMA. They had to protect themselves.
Some refugees took knives from the dining facilities. Other people made their own. In fact, Omar and I saw some of these confiscated weapons back at Fort McCoy. They'd previously been on display in their historical center. Public affairs coordinator Tanya Townsell removed them before we arrived. We stumbled upon them in a back room while searching for documents.
She would have been very vocal. So these are the shivs that I removed.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of them looks like a knife. This may have been from the dining facility, although it kind of looks like it was crafted, maybe.
So how, like, I wonder, I guess, because something that you read about is that they actually, the jefes were the ones carrying this kind of stuff. Or even just like broomsticks or, you know, branches from a tree to like keep the order. But this would do a lot more than keeping the order, I think.
Doesn't this look like a part from a bed?
I was just going to say, I suspect that the bed would still be able to work even if they took a piece out of it.
My heart was racing a little bit when I was folding those inks, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Especially those knives, because it probably hurt somebody.
Yeah.
Omar, this really shook you up.
Yes, I remember looking at those knives, and it was an object back from home. It was something that maybe I'd seen in my teenager years during Escuela al Campo times, because people made knives there. It was a flashback to very specific times in my life in Cuba when violence had been present. And then I thought, what if one of my friends like Ernesto or Nino had a knife? And even if they didn't, they lived under the threat of one, either ready to hurt somebody or defend themselves. Now that I've gotten to know these guys in La Crosse, I know some of them would have had a knife at Fort McCoy.
The day-to-day violence at Fort McCoy was a very serious and immediate problem. But big picture, government officials were trying to avoid large-scale riots, like the ones that had taken place at other camps.
Yes, like the riot at Fort Chaffee in Arkansas in early June of 1980. Up to 3,000 Maria refugees there rioted while shouting Libertad. People set buildings on fire, jumped the fence. Police outside the base opened fire on those who left the camp. Dozens of people were injured.
Officials of relief agencies working at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, say the main reason for last week's rioting by the Cubans being held there was boredom. The exiles sit and wait with little to do until they can be relocated.
After Sunday's rioting, a number of the Cuban regulars, as it were, formed vigilante groups, which are tipping off the authorities when they discover criminal activity within the camp. And occasionally, security officers conduct searches for weapons based on those tips.
How long do you think you'll have to stay here?
Oh, I don't know. But it doesn't matter to me because I have to wait. I have to wait 21 years in Cuba. And it doesn't matter to me to wait here 2 months, 2 months more.
Security officers have rounded up over 100 people who have been charged with crimes in Sunday's riot. For National Public Radio at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, I'm Steve Proffitt.
Fort McCoy never had a riot on the same scale as Fort Chaffee, but there were a few mini-riots. A two-day disturbance was the result of an unfounded rumor that Cuban refugees were being sold to sponsors. Another smaller riot took place as a group waited to be transferred to a federal prison.
Many of the unmarried men among the Cubans are homosexual. A rather larger portion of these Cuban refugees, as opposed to the initial tens of thousands who came after the revolution of the late 1950s, are black. I find it difficult to believe a visitor who cautions that the rights they're insured by law in the United States are not always reflected in the social attitudes of its citizens. I'm inclined to compare that to what I hear.
People outside of Fort McCoy were hearing and reading about some of these incidents inside the camp. Jillian Marie Jacklin is a lecturer at UW-Green Bay. When she was getting her PhD in history at UW-Madison, she published a paper that examined media coverage of Mariel refugees, specifically diving into local newspapers in La Crosse, Sparta, and Toma. She wanted to see how people were talking about the refugees in their own communities. Of course, there were crime stories.
That's sort of a primary focus, right, of the local news articles and reporting is that communities are unsafe, right, with refugees being around.
There was also a lot of reporting on fights inside Fort McCoy, people jumping the fence to get out, robberies and home break-ins in communities close to Fort McCoy.
Jillian even found articles that reported on threats aimed towards the refugees.
So, for instance, in local media, you'll find articles that talk about perhaps rather than shooting turkeys, shooting Cuban refugees to keep the area safer. Majorly racist, xenophobic commentary by local residents about how much they didn't want Fort McCoy to serve as a detention center. But, you know, local media sort of picking up on sexual difference being a threat and a danger to local communities.
Jillian found in her research that the stories not only looked at violence and crime, they also looked at the refugees' impact on the economy in the midst of a national recession.
So, sort of, these refugees are coming to take our jobs. This is the narrative that continues right today, that already unemployment rate is high. What would the appearance of these extra people who maybe will work for less money, perhaps undervaluing wages, when people who already lived in the region were suffering economically?
There were other kinds of articles, profiles on the refugees and updates on the resettlement process, local reactions, but Jillian found very little reporting from the Cuban refugees' perspectives.
That's not very fair and balanced, right? Where are the voices of the refugees themselves? How could we tell positive stories?
As a reporter, I can tell you it's pretty common to take a national story like the recession and localize it. And of course, from a public safety perspective, crime stories need to be reported since communities need to know what's going on around them.
However, this coverage was actually really problematic for Black Cubans. Locals were becoming more nervous about sponsoring the remaining refugees. As a reminder, Cubans were not documented or permanent residents. They needed sponsors to get out, someone to vouch for them and help them adjust to their new lives in a new country. So even though they've been admitted into the base and they are on American soil, they have absolutely no status as a citizen or a refugee. You're on parole. And that is actually the same status that some of them still have 40 years later.
Despite these stories, the resettlement efforts at Fort McCoy gained momentum. People started getting out. Some people stayed in Wisconsin, like Rodosfaldo Pozo or Nino. He was sponsored in September of 1980.
He was working in the kitchen. He told me, I got a sponsor over there.
One of the Fort McCoy kitchen workers paired him up with a family who lived nearby. They were a young couple who had three kids.
She said, they like you. Do you want to? You like baby? I said, yeah. You want to go to the house? They're going to sponsor you. You okay? I said, yeah. So next day they came and brought me a coat and a nice Monte Carlo, brand new.
Classic Nino, riding out of Fort McCoy in style in a brand new Monte Carlo. He ended up staying with his family for a bit. Even though they don't talk much today, he says he still loves them.
And then there was Ernesto Rodriguez. Remember how he spent a lot of time in the kitchen? Well, this is also where he met Brian and Joe Brandstetter, two brothers from Sparta, whose parents would eventually sponsor Erne. Here's Erne and Brian.
I see him, his brother, was separated. Two people was fighting with him. And we told his brother,
Joe,
yo, get out of there. You're going to get killed. Get out of there. Because he was separated.
Trying to stop it.
Stop it. And we said, no, get out of there. Because those people was crazy.
Crazy Cubans.
Ernest saved Joe. And in a way, this helped him connect with his sponsors, the Brandstetters. This relationship led him to put down his roots in the upper Midwest.
But those men remaining are often without friends or the endearments of family, without job skills or education.
Perhaps these people came over and they did have criminal backgrounds of some sort or another and thought, this will be my chance to start over, to be somebody new. And then when they see maybe it isn't going to be their chance to start over, then the hostility really builds up.
Omar, what about the people who couldn't find sponsors? Who was stuck at the end?
Well, first, there were about 90 unaccompanied minors. The minors were sent to live at Wyalusing State Park near Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Then there were the adults. As winter approached, the government consolidated all the unsponsored adult refugees across the country into one camp. These were mostly young, single black men.
I left, talk about 1980.
Osvaldo Durruti was one of the 3,200 Cubans at Fort McCoy who never found a sponsor in Wisconsin. He was sent to Fort Chaffee in Arkansas.
We were here in McCoy, and from here we went to Fort Chaffee, and from Fort Chaffee we got a sponsor of the whole group.
Oh, I didn't realize you were at Fort Chaffee, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because Madison was being too cold for us.
Yeah.
Almost 15,000 Cubans had passed through the gates of Fort McCoy in the summer and fall of 1980. They traveled thousands of miles to sleep in military barracks with no window screens. They'd helped set up school classrooms, church services, baseball games, and musical groups.
Some made lifelong friends. One couple got married there. Babies were born to refugees at the camp. In fact, the first one was born on the 4th of July. Others faced violence, prejudice, and trauma. They survived in whatever ways they could, dreaming of the day they could get out.
And then they did get out.
On November 3rd, 1980, the last Cuban refugees left Fort McCoy. On the next episode of Uprooted.
I had a friend say to me once, aren't you scared they're going to go and stab your parents during the middle of the night? I'm like, my brothers.
Wow. Sponsor all 12 of them. And I got them an apartment over on West Mifflin Street.
They give me everything. I don't need nothing. They give me everything.
The Cuban Wisconsinites leave Fort McCoy and begin their new lives.
They need to find jobs, learn a new language, and some start families.
Uprooted is reported, written, and produced by me, executive producer Maureen McCollum, along with Omar Granados. Our producer and technical director is Brad Kohlberg. We're edited by Brady Carlson. Music direction and composition by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich, Peter Bryant, Hannah Haynes, and Ezra Wall. Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. The digital design team is Jane Jumale, Amanda Starich, and Anna Rudin. Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. And special thanks to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Murphy Library for archival photos. Artwork by Grace Lorenz. Our theme music is the song Bozo Part 3 by Willie Chirino. Additional music from Compay Segundo and La Familia Valera Miranda. Archival audio from NPR's Research Archives and Data Strategy team. You can see more at wpr.org/uprooted.